The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 122, Music in the Church, What Can Be Done, by Joseph Downing, with comments by Marianne Morgan. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes of the second side of the tape will be blank.
We want to welcome you to this session of Music in the Church, What Can Be Done. We encourage you to sit forward so that you can really hear what's going on and be part of this. I'll tell you a little bit about the participants. Joseph Downing is currently Chair of Composition, Theory, and History at the Syracuse University School of Music. Dr. Downing is a Fellow of the Royal Canadian College of Organists and currently serves as Dean of the Syracuse Chapter of the American Guild of Organists. In addition to serving as stake music chairman in stakes in Utah, the Midwest, Canada, and New York, he has been director of music at Irving Park United Methodist Church in Chicago and First Presbyterian Church in Syracuse. He is currently organist at Temple, I'm not sure I'm saying this right, Adith Yeshurun in Syracuse. He is going to give his paper, and then he will be responded to by Mary Ann Morgan. She is a freelance musician, a violinist, a pianist, who has had a wide variety of experience in the music world. We want to turn the time over to them. Dr. Downing has 30 minutes. She'll have about 15 to respond, and then you'll have a chance to ask some questions.
Good morning. In the September 1992 Sunstone, Paul Poli, who's on the faculty at BYU, wrote an article documenting the deterioration of music in the church. Subsequently, there was a letter to the editor which asked for constructive suggestions which could help remedy the situation. And this article, this paper, proposes to do just that. I regret that it does seem, first of all, necessary to list the many problems of music in the church. Be assured that real solutions are also included in this paper. Now, the importance of music in the church is not going to be discussed. Anyone who questions whether high-level music making is part of the gospel is encouraged to read John Taylor's Prophecy of the Saints and Their Music, Spencer Kimball's famous The Gospel Vision of the Art speech from the Ensign, and the preface of the First Presidency to the 1985 hymn book. It is true that the church seems to be doing just fine in spite of its weak music programs. However, the church also survives in spite of the occasional terrible gospel doctrine lesson, a wacko priesthood class, a truly bizarre testimony meeting. No one would be content in maintaining the status quo should any of these aberrations become the norm. We are a church that believes in perfection and should be earnestly striving to perfect our programs. Clearly, the music program is in need of much perfecting. In the LDS Church, poor music is currently the norm. Let us then proceed with the assumption that music is important and that it has not yet reached its potential within the church. The woeful state of music in the church is well known both by men. Within the church, the greatest discontent is often with converts who were previously active Protestants and remember what things are like, or what things were like, rather, in the old church. And I note this especially living in the Northeast, where the vast majority of people are converts to the church from other Christian denominations. A sister in a stake choir recently approached me and said, "I've been LDS for 20 years, and the only thing that I miss in my old church is the music." Members born in the church are often unaware of the significant role that music could play in the worship service. I've heard a high counselor comment, "Well, sure, it says in the handbook that choirs are supposed to be in every ward, but they don't really mean that. Choirs are for conferences." To my amazement, a now-retired tabernacle organist once told me that real music is never going to happen in the wards. You have to come to Temple Square. How unfortunate this defeatist attitude is that in a worldwide church, only those within commuting distance of Salt Lake could experience good music as part of their worship. Now, no one has delusions that a small branch choir is going to compete with the Tabernacle Choir in CD sales. But overambitious music programs are not the problem in the church. By far, the problem is underambitious or non-existent programs. In 1975, Dialogue did a special issue on music in the church. The issue concluded with a discussion between two prominent LDS musicians, pianist Reed Nibley and organist-composer Norberto Guinaldo. Brother Nibley was very confident that things were on the upswing and pointed to several ward choirs who regularly did significant choral works, such as the Brahms Requiem. Brother Guinaldo was much more pessimistic and felt that quality programs were unusual and decreasing in number. Needless to say, Brother Guinaldo's predictions have proven true. Music in the church has significantly decreased in the past 25 years, both in terms of quantity and quality. Outside of the church, people are aware of our problems. When I was a beginning graduate school, I met Dennis Northway, who was a fellow student with a quick wit and a wide grin. When I told him I was a Mormon, he feigned shock, and he said, "How can you belong to that bait-and-switch church?" Confused, I asked him to explain. He said, "Oh, I know all about you Mormons. You have great organs and great choirs where the public can see them, so people think you have great music programs. You get them all excited, and then they go to their local worship box and wonder if they're in the same place because the music's so terrible." What could I say? Now, Dennis was purposely goading me, but he had a point. Another example demonstrates the church's reputation in the field of music. There's a worldwide group of organ enthusiasts who converse on the internet. Topics range from technical construction matters to humorous anecdotes. A few months ago, someone in Germany posted a notification of an organ festival to be held in the city of Bad, B-A-D. To our amusement, the English title of the festival was the Bad Organ Festival. Someone fired back, "Just how bad is your organ festival?" The first response to the international audience was, "This organ festival is so bad, all the events are held in LDS churches." Because the problems of music in the church are many-faceted, there can be no one simple solution. In order for music to become the significant spiritual experience prophesied by Presidents Taylor and Kimball, changes will have to be made both at the local and general level. In the past, too often leaders have thought that one simple statement could affect profound changes and have been disappointed at the results. Simple and cheap solutions have clearly been ineffective in improving music in the church. For example, pulpit chastisement of congregations for unenthusiastic congregational singing will promote little change where there are incompetent musicians using inadequate instruments in a discouraging acoustic. While it is not necessary, nor likely, to have supportive leaders with excellent musicians playing fabulous instruments in resonant acoustics before music will again become meaningful in the worship service, it is clear that improvement is needed in a variety of fronts. Improvement is needed in the areas of educating and preparing new musicians, making music a priority in the wards, designing chapels which acoustically encourage congregational singing, respecting and encouraging diversity of musical styles, and providing quality organs. In searching for solutions, we should look to those who have been successful rather than personal theories. There is reticence on the part of many to consider non-LDS models. This is unwise and neither historical nor scriptural. Joseph Smith said, "Have the Presbyterians any truth? Yes. Have the Baptists, Methodists, etc., any truth? Yes. They all have a little truth mixed with error." And usually that's where the quote ends, but that's not where he stopped. He said, we should gather all the good and true principles in the world and treasure them up, or we shall not come out as true Mormons. First, let's eliminate those answers which do not work. Some have proposed that evolving technology may eliminate the need for local musicians, that perhaps automatic organs or satellite link-ups from Salt Lake can fill the musical needs of local congregations. These solutions fail to recognize the first principle of effective music. Music is made by musicians. While a broadcast can be impressive, watching a faraway choir while listening to a PA system rarely, if ever, produces the intimate communication and spirit of live music. Other than providing a good example, the music that happens in the tabernacle has little influence on the spirit in sacrament meetings in Peoria, Pittsburgh, and Poughkeepsie. Likewise, devices which play organs automatically or tapes of organ accompaniments can never be sensitive to the spirit which is present in the room. A good organist will vary the registration, phrasing, and tempo of a hymn relative to the congregational size and mood. The communication between singers, directors, and organists is an essential part of the musical experience. Improved technology has not given us improved music. Improved musicians and facilities produce improved music. I have to tell a little anecdote in here. I had a friend in the Guild of Organists who, not a member of the church, who came and said her minister had said, he had been approached by a salesman who said, you know, if you put in a good sound system, I have these organ CDs, and your organist isn't all that hot. Really, you know, why don't you just use these recordings of hymns, you know? They're regular, they'll be reliable, and I said, somebody sitting at the same table turned to her and said, well, have you told the minister that there's also really good tapes of sermons, actually better sermons that he gives, and perhaps, you know, you could use those in the sermon time? To which I added, and you know, if you go to any novelty store, you can get full-size posters of individuals. You could put that in the congregation and nobody would have to go there on Sunday morning. You could have organ music, preaching, and congregation. Simplifying music produces short-term results, but in the long term does not encourage the development of musicians. There is, of course, a real need for simplified accompaniments for hymns in areas where there is no one with the technical skills to play the composer's original hymn. Where the use of simplified hymns and simplified accompaniments has become normal, the subtle message is given that music is not sufficiently important to require any real effort. In fact, the best hymn accompaniments are often more difficult than the four-part choral version of the hymn found in the hymn book. Unfortunately, in today's church, the cry of simplify, simplify is often heard. The goal should be improve, improve. In my experience, the best church music programs have always had one or two key individuals with expertise at their foundation. While it is true that the Holy Spirit has often blessed the efforts of less trained individuals on many occasions, it has never been my experience that sustained excellence and spirituality in music can be maintained by the willfully ignorant. Oliver Cowdery learned this lesson when the Lord chastised him, saying, behold, you have not understood. You have supposed that I would give it unto you, and you took no thought save it was to ask me. But behold, I say unto you that you must study it out. Both organists and choral directors require substantial training if their efforts are to be fruitful. Let us first consider the educational needs of organists. Sometimes a stake will offer one or two organ workshops and expect to see change. Playing the organ requires much physical coordination in addition to musical understanding. Most organ teachers would agree that a firm piano technique is prerequisite to organ study. Mozart sonatas, Bach two-part inventions. A reasonably intelligent individual with this piano preparation will require about 100 hours of organ instruction with about 1,000 hours of productive practice to be able to play most hymns in the hymn book. Assuming practice of 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, with an hour lesson each week during the academic year, this could be accomplished in about 3 years. This will not produce a tabernacle organist in recital. It'll produce someone who can competently play hymns with a repertoire of, let's say, a dozen prelude, postlude pieces. To expect any more of 3 years' study is unrealistic. To expect someone to be competent at the organ with any less training is equally unrealistic. After a recent state conference, a member of the High Council approached me and said that he loved the way I played hymns and asked if I would be willing to teach his son, who was a promising young pianist. Because they lived 70 miles away, I suggested some competent teachers in their area. He replied that they were not interested in long-term commitment, but just wanted to meet with me a couple of times for some pointers so that he could play like me. Afterwards, I wondered if he really thought that I learned to play hymns inspiringly after 2 or 3 hours of pointers. If we are to have competent organists, we have to make a commitment to their education. Too many units hope year after year that they will be lucky enough to have a competent organist to move in. If you wonder what that's like, when you're moving to an area, identify yourself as an organist and see how many calls you get from bishops. You know, offers of help with real estate, finding a house. For most units, their luck ran out a long time ago. Every ward should have at least one person studying the organ at all times. What could be done by a local leader to encourage commitment? In days past, the church sent promising musicians east to study. Promising pianists could be called to study the organ. Perhaps the local unit could assume financial responsibility to encourage study with the most competent individual available. And I just found out this week of some bishops in the California area who have done exactly that, who are either reimbursing the cost of organ lessons or splitting the cost. Choral directors would benefit by studying voice, piano, and sight singing and participating in community choral programs. I'm amazed at the number of LDS choir directors whose chief qualification is enthusiasm. These people give the most amazingly uninformed technical advice. Worse are those who are proud of their ignorance, who suspect that learning basic skills will somehow take away from their reliance on the Spirit. Quite to the contrary, the Lord has commanded us to be instructed more perfectly in theory, in principle, in doctrine, in the law of the gospel, in all things that pertain unto the kingdom of God that are expedient for us to understand. All church musicians would benefit greatly by membership in a church music organization. In the United States, the American Guild of Organists. Canada, the Royal Canadian College of Organists. All countries have an equivalent. Although both entitles imply that membership is limited to organists, they're both really organizations of church musicians. Contrary to the fears of many, there's no entrance exams. Yearly dues, about $70, often paid by churches rather than individuals. And this leads to about a dozen organ and choral workshops annually. Because I learned most of what I know about church music through these two groups, I firmly believe that every organist in the church should become an active member. The current chain of command structure in the church does not and cannot provide for the education necessary to develop musicians in the church. There is presently no direct contact between the church music department and local musicians. Any suggestion from the church music department must be filtered through area presidencies, area authorities, stake presidents, bishops, before the information actually reaches a musician. Needless to say, any musical information is of little value by the time it passes through five levels of non-musicians. The most obvious solution would be to set up a parallel, more direct line of communications, which would, of course, still be subject to priesthood authority, somewhat similar, perhaps, to the seminary and institute program. Full or part-time professional area musicians could be employed who would develop need-specific, ongoing area educational programs and supervise musical instrument purchase and maintenance. The ward choir should provide the foundation for music in every worship service. President Kimball said, if you don't have a ward choir, you're not fully organized, any more than if you don't have a relief society. And just because of time, I'm going to edit just a little bit right now. In my paper, I compare, though, the way that choirs are treated with the way that the primary is treated. In one of the wards in our stake, I can think of an example where at the same time they set up the primary, they called 9 adults to administer the needs for 14 children. They gave them a place to meet, a time to meet, handbooks, prepared materials. At the same time, they called a ward choir director with one individual, said, you figure out the time, you figure out the place, figure out where you're going to get music from, there's no budget. You call all the individuals who feel no obligation whatsoever to participate in this. So that sort of situation needs to change. The choir needs to be an integral part of the service. It needs to sing every week. It's much easier, just like it's much easier to exercise twice a week regularly than to do it this week and not exercise next week. It's the same thing with singing and with establishing a choir. You need to, you know, if you had 2 rehearsals a week, a short one before sacrament meeting, 1 during the week, in no time the choir is sounding terrific, and it's not an issue. It's not difficult to maintain that. Obviously, a budget needs to be provided. Photocopying. I was in one ward where they had 4 filing cabinets of music, of which 3 of them were full of photocopied music, illegally photocopied. Of course, the hymn book can also be used, but it's a mistake to rely too heavily on the hymn book for choral music. It is, after all, intended for congregational use, and choir members quickly find choir practice pointless when they're doing no more than they could do from the congregation. Congregations are also somewhat confused by singing unarranged hymns. You know, our choir isn't all that terrific. Why don't we all just sing this? Of course, specially arranged hymns, arranged to highlight the text and provide more beauty, are a mainstay of choral repertoire. Perhaps few leaders understand the amount of time required to do an adequate job in church music positions. At one point, I was both executive secretary and young men's president in a ward. I've also served as an elders' quorum president in the ward, and even considering all the meetings involved, none of these callings required the same amount of time and commitment as being ward choir director. When I was employed by the Presbyterian Church, I was allotted 20 hours weekly to prepare for the one-hour service. That was choir and organ music. Music was chosen from the library of over 1,700 anthems indexed by topic to relate to the theme for the day, or any theme that I wanted. It was also arranged so I could find text based on scriptures. It was unthinkable to go into a choir practice without knowing every part and having a clear plan for rehearsing the music for the next month's services. The LDS requirements are really not that much simpler. The choir director must be prepared, and the music should be coordinated with the spoken word. The organist who merely sight-reads hymns during the service will probably encourage less than inspirational congregational singing. Music callings, properly done, are extremely demanding and time-consuming. It's unfair and unrealistic to treat them as anything less. Now, here's the controversial part. Local leaders can also be supportive and appreciative of the contributions of marginalized members of the church. For some unknown reason, there is a particularly high correlation between successful church musicians and male homosexuality. The only thing I can think of comparing it to is there seems to be a high correlation between African Americans and basketball. If you look at the NBA, no one would deny that there are an awful lot of African Americans who play basketball. Likewise, there are an awful lot of male homosexuals who are organists and church musicians. In fact, I will state that in the chapter of the Guild of Organists, of which I am dean, I probably know fairly well about 40 men in the chapter. I can say that less than 10% of them, considerably less than 10% of them, are heterosexual. In the church, we like to pretend that this is not true, but the simple facts are that membership in the LDS church has no effect on sexual orientation, and the incidence of homosexuality within the church appears to be no different than without. That the correlation between organists, particularly, and homosexuality is well known is evidenced by a former state president's wife who confided to my wife that although her son was an excellent pianist, she was hesitant to have him study the organ in case it made him turn gay. My wife explained that while there was a high correlation, it was not a causative one, and her son's sexual orientation would be unaffected by studying the organ. The stake president's wife decided to err on the side of caution and forewent the organ lessons. Now, whether their son turned gay or not, I do not know, but the stake lost a potential organist because of her homophobia. In times past, this correlation was openly acknowledged, and gay musicians were appreciated and free to be open about their lives. As we know, Evan Stevens lived fairly openly as a gay man in Salt Lake City. Indeed, he was very public at times about his private life and described his life companions, as well as sharing poetry about them in the Primary magazine. Nowadays, gay church members are much more closeted. There's no doubt that they are present in approximately the same ratios as they've always been, but speaking openly about their private lives, it's much more likely to bring about an excommunication rather than an interview in the Primary magazine. The church seems to be the only army that shoots its own wounded. Given this hostile environment, gay musicians are faced with the choices of remaining closeted, drifting into silent inactivity, or being open and facing ostracization or excommunication. And there are people who have made each choice, from the current Temple Square musician who leads a double life, to, in my branch, the local inactive religion professor who plays organ for an Episcopal church, to a friend of mine, the now excommunicated former Tabernacle associate organist, who is currently the music director for a large Protestant church. Clearly, in many churches, these gentle men are respected for their spirituality as well as their musicianship. Clearly, life under LDS church policies is difficult at best for gay members. Where a supportive environment is provided, all members are free to share their talents and gifts for the benefit of all. Some musical problems need to be addressed at the general level, and one is the distressing acoustics of most LDS chapels. And I'm going to skip most of this section again in the interest of time because I'm running out, and also because there have been vast improvements made in acoustics in LDS worship places in the last 10 years. The chapels that they're building now are so vastly improved acoustically from the days when the philosophy was kill every sound in the room and then use a mic so you can hear the speaker. Another problem that desperately needs to be addressed at the general level is the instruments used for worship. The trend towards electronic keyboards is just plain bad. In our meeting house, there's a little church-issue electronic keyboard in the room in which the priesthood meets. The sound is so strange, one of the options for the sounds is frog chorus, that the men prefer to sing without accompaniment, or more recently, in about the last 2 months, in our priesthood meetings, we've just dispensed with any hymn singing. Because although there are often, you know, a dozen different sounds possible, they're all multiple versions of ugly. In the church, the vast majority of organs, even in the chapels, are low-end stock model electronic substitutes with utility-grade speakers. It might come as a surprise to know that it is much more difficult to play an electronic organ than it is to play a wall-built pipe organ. I remember President Hinckley coming to the Toronto Ontario Stake Center, and he brought then senior tabernacle organist Robert Kundick, and the organ sounded just terrible. And President Hinckley turned to the stake president, a friend of mine, and said, good grief, you'd think he could do better on a church issue instrument. And the stake president didn't say anything, but later said to me, if you've got Dr. Robert Kundig, senior tabernacle organist, fellow of the American Guild of Organists, and he can't make the thing sound good, what are we supposed to do with our local musicians? Probably, and I'm going to explain this really quickly because I think it's important. I'm going to tell you why it's harder to play an electronic. As you can imagine, anyone who studied the organ knows that the hardest thing is to learn to play with your feet. And yet, on an electronic organ, the volume pedal must be maintained all the time because you're using electronic resources. When you add stops, they don't add volume the same way that they do on a pipe organ. So you never can take your right foot off the volume pedal. You just can't do it. When I play electronic organs, and I have a distressingly large history of playing them, the right foot is just on the volume pedal, which means that you're never going to learn to play the pedals right. Well, if you don't play the pedals right, then you're doing different things with your hands. You can't stretch on an organ like you can on a piano. So you're doomed to having a very difficult time. As opposed to on a pipe organ, quite often there isn't even a volume pedal there. It's built for the room. It will always be the appropriate sound. You pull that stop, it'll always be identical, just made for that room. The main reason that electronic, I'm going to skip this part again. Perhaps the best feature of electronic organs is that they only last as long as any other electronic device. By age 10, they are old. How many 20-year-old TVs? How many 20-year-old computers are still used? The technology of electronic organs is exactly the same, relies on the same principles. Now, the oldest pipe organ in the world is in Sion, Switzerland. It was built sometime prior to 1390 and is still played weekly, although Parley Belknap, head of organ at BYU, told me when I was a student, he said, I think that they did some work on it in the 1600s. You know? Should we not be building instruments now that are going to take us through the millennium? Some people think that the average person can't, you know, you always hear the story, we don't have any musicians who can appreciate the difference between untrue, complete lie. There is such a small, insignificant portion of the population that does not appreciate the difference. And I think once in Illinois, our organ had died, and I had a friend there who had a small portable pipe organ, and we brought it in for state conference. So as we're setting it up the day before, a lady from the Spanish ward came up. Now, as you know, that's not from a tradition that has a high, has a lot of people with a lot of training in music or any familiarity with pipe organs. And she said, can you play that for me for a second? So I turned my back and I was just playing Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, a little bit of that on it. And I turned around and the woman was standing there with tears streaming down her face. She said, I've never heard anything that beautiful in my life. Likewise, when they wanted to replace that organ, we went to a nearby Lutheran church where they had put in a small but beautiful pipe organ. Before we would go there, the stake president insisted that we go to the Schomburg stake where they had the latest church issue, actually one model above standard church issue for a stake center. We took three organists, one of whom was the stake president's wife, and everyone said, yeah, it's fine. Sounds like an organ. Yep, yep, yep. You know, and we played various things. Yeah, yep, yep. Sounds fine. I don't see the problem. Then we went to the Lutheran church. When we went in there, first of all, the visual beauty of the instrument, the bishop who had been the most opposed to the project just said, oh, my word, I had no idea. And I started to repeat the demonstration that we had done on, and the first time I played a chord on the organ, he said, you don't have to go through that whole demonstration. It's so obvious. This is a man with no training in music. Everyone left the Lutheran church on a spiritual high, And unfortunately, no one in the purchasing department at Salt Lake could be persuaded to share our enthusiasm. The stock model electronic was ordered and installed 10 years later. There's no one in that stake who studies the organ. I don't think that there's probably anyone who's ever been moved by the organ music in the stake. As far as the issue of size, I did a study last year of pipe organs in built-in American churches. Here's the results. 154 pipe organs were put in non-LDS American churches last year. The average size of these organs was 28 ranks. And you have to understand that ranks to an organist are like ingredients to a cook. If you have 5 ingredients, there's so many recipes you can make. If you have 20 ingredients, you can do a lot more with that. Well, the average size was about 28 ranks, which is pretty conservative. The Tabernacle organ has over 200 ranks of pipes. When Gounod wrote, everyone in the LDS Church knows Gounod's O Divine Redeemer. He planned that, the accompaniment for that, for an organ of about 50 ranks. Most of Bach's works can be played on an organ of about 40 ranks. American churches average 28 ranks. So it shows that there's budgetary concerns and people are being conservative. Meanwhile, in the LDS Church, there were 4 organs built last year. 4. Even though we have the biggest building program, each of those organs had 9 ranks. We're not even in the ballpark. We're not even in the ballpark. And I could go on that, but I'm not going to because my time is really up. And let me see if there's anything else that I... concluding paragraph. The task of improving music in the church may seem daunting. There is much to be done. Musicians must be trained and educated. Chapels must acoustically encourage congregational singing. Quality organs must be installed. Individual callings must be extended to people who will magnify their responsibilities. There must be tolerance for diversity, but it is possible. And I believe that the increase of spirituality in our worship service and in the lives of our members will make it all very worthwhile. Thank you.
I wish Dr. Downing were in charge of the whole program. He reminds us occasionally that we witness a terrible gospel doctrine lesson, a wacko priesthood class, or bizarre testimony meeting. He states that no one would be content in maintaining the status quo should any of these aberrations become the norm. I agree with him there, but believe that most people in the church, including those in leadership positions, are quite content and satisfied with mediocrity in music. We have mostly amateur musicians for so long, we have had mostly amateur musicians for so long that mediocre is all many people know. The problem, I believe, is one of education and exposure. Those who have studied music seriously have only grown to love the classics more deeply through our struggles to master them. We have begun many pieces of music ignorantly or reluctantly at the urging of a teacher or a conductor. Perhaps a piece was too complex or inaccessible on a first hearing, not to mention our futile efforts at trying to play or sing it for the first time. But as we mastered the technical difficulties, turned the mechanics into music, and gave the piece much love and attention, a magical experience occurred. We have experienced the incredible joy, even spirituality, of performing a great piece of music. In fact, the drug produces such a high that we've been willing to practice the thousands of hours it takes to repeat the experience again and again. Not all good music is complex, and not all complex music is good. But unraveling the intricacies of a great piece of music to make it one's own is a learned taste. Expecting our congregations to immediately value what we value is somewhat unrealistic, especially when one contemplates the large amount of mediocre and poor music that we're subjected to at the grocery store, in elevators, in doctor's offices, on TVs, and even on the telephone. I'm sure Dr. Downing would agree with David Dalton, my music history teacher at BYU over 30 years ago, when he told us that our role as musicians in the church should be one of education and of good example, to raise the standard. That is all well and good if you are calling the shots, but when the music and equipment we are expected to use is dictated by others, good luck. We moved to Salt Lake in 1974. I was a young mother with two children and one on the way. Naturally, I was called to serve in the primary and eventually ended up as a chorister. I had grown up in southern Utah, but had recently taught general music in the 4th, 5th, and 6th grades of the San Francisco Unified School District. An education for me to teach Hispanic kids in the Mission District, Japanese kids in the Avenues, blacks in the Bayview District, and Filipinos at the Bessie Carmichael School. The cultural richness of San Francisco was heady to a girl raised in Cedar City, where for the most part, people were Mormons from European ancestry. Returning to Utah with a one-year-old and a three-year-old, I wanted my own children and their peers to have more of an introduction to other cultures than I had had as a child. After all, wouldn't the church be growing and expanding in the world? Wouldn't that be important? Shouldn't we learn to love others and other cultures? And what better way than through music? At primary, we had learned all of the music for the sacrament meeting program and presented it a month early. The new music for the following year's program wasn't out yet, so I supposed that I could teach a little cultural awareness and appreciation for another way of praising God. There were two spirituals in the fifth grade songbook from my teaching days that the kids at school had loved. I thought they would be just right for primary. The primary kids enjoyed being introduced to the songs, but before I could continue the lesson the next week, I was called to the primary president's home to be told that what I was teaching wasn't appropriate. Someone had complained. Naive me. I was stunned. Hadn't I taught everything that we were required to teach? Hadn't these new songs everything to do with praising God? Superior agreed that I had and that they did. Still, these were Negro spirituals, and Negroes couldn't even hold the priesthood. I maintained that we needed to bridge some pretty big prejudicial rivers, that children were broadened by enjoying music from other cultures, and besides, I protested, even the tabernacle choir sings spirituals, so they must be okay with the church. In the end, of course, the decision wasn't mine. It says in the handbook that we should use only approved songs. I wish I could say that now, over 20 years later, I feel more freedom in making musical choices, but I do not. I didn't think I was so emotional about this, but it really, I've had some experiences that have discouraged me no end. An experience of a year ago will illustrate. About a month until state conference, I was asked to direct a girls' chorus. The state president requested Beautiful Savior. Simple Gifts and St. James Air were the other two pieces of music which I selected. The state presidency had given final permission on the selections. They had to give final permission on the selections, which they did. I wasn't even allowed to choose the music without their permission. And they gave their permission. We quickly special ordered enough vocal parts and arranged string parts for the chamber orchestra that has been a part of conference in our state for over 50 years. Knowing that you can't get everyone every time for a rehearsal, I arranged for an hour rehearsal daily for 4 days of the week for 2 weeks. Things were going pretty well when I got a call from a counselor in the state president, to the state president asking if we could change to hymns. You'd think that by now these experiences wouldn't surprise me, but surprised I was. I reminded him that the song our state president had requested wasn't even in the hymn book, Beautiful Savior, and that they had reviewed the other two pieces of music and that they had given permission to use them. We had gone to quite a bit of expense to secure the music, had a week's worth of rehearsals under our belt, and were only a week away from conference. But even more important, the music was appropriate. In these layers straight, I can't really remember who it was, had complimented the stake on doing almost everything right, but that we needed to use the hymns in our music. The bottom line was that the higher authority had spoken. I complained terribly, but could see that the die was cast. Because I didn't want to fight, we compromised. Simple Gifts was sung as a prelude. Apparently, it was appropriate at 9:55, but it was inappropriate at 10:05. Beautiful Savior was allowed because it had been requested by the stake president. And St. James Air was finally allowed when I suggested that we sing a hymn right after an interlude between it and the hymn, making it a sort of medley. After that experience, I was so frustrated that I thought the best solution for me was to take my energies into the community and volunteer in some inner city school rather than at the church. I had supposed that when one is set apart for a particular job in the church, one is entitled to inspiration. If that is true, one should be taken seriously. I have taken music selection very seriously, prayed about it, and prepared well to present it. I couldn't agree more with Dr. Downing that most people don't have a clue about the time it takes to prepare well for a music job. The biggest problem, as I see it, is that those who hold power in the decision-making processes don't have the same musical values that musicians such as Dr. Downing and I have. While a pipe organ isn't affordable, tens of thousands of dollars have been spent throughout the church on punch and cookies. I'll have to say that there have been bright spots in my crusade for good music. Over 10 years ago, I asked and was given permission to try to mount a Messiah for Christmas. I bought the complete orchestral score and several dozen choral scores. After calling everyone in my ward directory about participating, we got a large number of people willing to meet at my house Sunday mornings to learn parts to four choruses. Each person wanting to sing was asked to buy a score. No one complained. We were fortunate to have some pretty good music students and musicians in our ward and were able to put together a fine orchestra with very little outside help. We chose several soloists and mounted our first effort. I knew that I wouldn't have to convince anyone about the quality of the music. Their own experience would confirm that. The result was far and away more successful than I had imagined. The effort continued and expanded every Christmas thereafter for almost a decade. I knew that the handbook says you aren't supposed to use brass in the chapel, but I felt that it was better not to ask about that. I just went ahead. The electricity in the chapel generated by our formerly inactive bass soloist who's sitting right down here and our neighborhood trumpet player who happens to be Catholic when they perform the trumpet shall sound is palpable. There was some rumblings a year ago about using a trumpet in the chapel and the bishop decided not to do the Messiah. There was so much complaining from members of our ward that we are back on for this year. I am absolutely convinced that those ward members pushing for a continuation of Messiah wouldn't have pushed had they not experienced the glory of the music personally. One suggestion Dr. Downey makes is that all church musicians join an organization such as the American Guild of Organists. I think it's a good idea, but wonder if maybe a practical first step in that direction might be for the Ensign to print an ongoing section for church musicians. Dr. Downey would no doubt be an excellent person to write that column. Another observation he has, with which I concur, is that the chain of command waters down suggestions from the church music committee to the musician by the time it goes through so many committees. The same can be said of more than one program in the church, but good luck for changing that. In the final analysis, we know that a ward's musical level reflects its lay members. When good musicians try to improve the quality of music in their wards and stakes, will they be successful? My experience is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Convincing those at the decision-making level that quality is important is the key. That's the essence of my whole paper, so I'm going to repeat that. Convincing those at the decision-making level that quality is important is the key. Also important is trusting a good musician to make appropriate decisions. A boon would be some input from musicians like Dr. Downing. For right now, music making on a high level doesn't seem to be a very high priority. Thanks.
I want to thank Dr. Downing and Marianne Morgan for contributing these very insightful papers. We have about 10 minutes for questions. If anyone has one, if you'll state it, and then I will repeat it so we can...
Okay. This is just a comment, basically. And this goes back to the idea of quality. I'm going to give just a short history here. I grew up in Westside Wood, in Salt Lake here, where there wasn't much money, but but there was a lot of raw talent. And during that time, we did a lot of things. Great thing. Come 1965, Coronation stepped in. And as far as I'm concerned, both musicians and musical members to the church, it is and remains an unmitigated disaster. The attitude now is, it really is, that we wish to foster mediocrity. I asked the question, when was the Tabernacle Choir performance scrapped? And my bishop said, well, that is different, and he referred me to the handbook that said, even though the Tabernacle used percussion, brass, etc., we cannot do it in our sacrament meeting. And I think what Mary Ann said about the idea of educating towards quality, and also stated in the paper, is something that is a long, hard process. We've got many, many, many more years. I don't see it happening until the whole bureaucracy is upended. Thank you.
I hope that was on the tape. I'm not going to try to repeat that. Is there anyone else who has a question they would like to address to either one of these two people? Yes. Yes, come right up.
First, I have to brag just a little bit. In my ward, we have almost 50 members in our ward choir, and we typically sing with almost 35. And in addition, we have a youth choir that has about 30 kids in it, none of whom sing in the adult choir. And a couple times we've even sung together. And what we haven't always had such good support for the choir, although we do have a lot of talent where I live in California. But what really makes a difference is having some really talented choir directors who put a lot of effort and who have a lot of musical training and who do an excellent job, and it makes singing in the choir a lot of fun. But the question that I would like to ask is, right now, while I'm here, actually tomorrow and the next day, they're holding a music workshop in the Bay Area. People come from BYU and also they draw on local musicians as well. And I've gone to it a couple of times, and I think it's been quite well done. And I'm wondering if you are familiar with any of the church music workshops that have been put on and what you feel about their potential for increasing the quality of music in the church.
I was, of course, the big one was at this past week down at BYU where there were hundreds of people there. These are absolutely fabulous, and I know that one of my frustrations, of course, is unlike my name tag said, I'm not from Syracuse, Utah. I'm from Syracuse, New York, and I've lived the vast majority of my life east of the Mississippi, and where there is not a high concentration of members. One of the things I'm going to be doing shortly is contacting the people who arranged the church music workshops and see if we can do one in the East, because I really think that they are a tremendous thing. You can get an awful lot of learning done in 3 or 4 days. So, you know, that's a wonderful thing that's happening here. And I wish it would get better publicity and that there would be regional ones. Well, I don't know who the entire chair of the event was. I have, of course, several friends at BYU who were teaching on the faculty there. And so I'm going to contact them and see who was it arranged the whole thing. I think that the first ones were done by BYU with not much correlation, I believe, from Salt Lake. And so I don't know whether we'll, you know, I'm at a university, so perhaps I can get my university to work something out with BYU. I'm not sure how much we'll get from the Church Music Committee, although they now at least send, I know Michael Moody, who's chair of the Church Music Committee, at least spoke and gave a session or two at the Church Music Workshop. So.
You indicated that the church has built 4 chapels with pipe organs in the last year. What's their criteria? Unless they were stake centers, I would imagine.
I had lunch with Clay Christiansen in the church office building just a week ago, and he was on his way to the musical instrument selection committee, so I asked him that. They base it upon, theoretically, if you read the handbook, you are asked how many trained organists there are in the stake, what does the stake president want to do. I found out something new. Evidently, your area authority, or excuse me, the area president has a lot of clout. I found out ours is Elder Featherston for New York, and the church has, he told me that the church had just bought a renovated build or a building from another denomination that was going to have four branches in it, ethnic branches, and Elder Featherston had said, we will repair this historic organ, which the church has never done, and it will have a functioning organ, and I can own from the builder that it's more than nine ranks. And that's what Clay told me, is if your area president says it will be, then it will be. He also told me of one area president who has said, in my area, there will be no pipe organs. End of matter.
We used to live in the Bay Area, 20 some odd years ago, and in San Francisco, the Bay Ward was down in a very bad part of town, and the church had saved for like 10 years to build a new chapel, and the Spreckles Mansion up on Knob Hill had been purchased. And the ward still didn't have enough money, so the church came in and said, well, we'll bail you out because it was such a bad area. And those of us who were interested in music said, oh, if you're going to build this beautiful chapel for LDS people in San Francisco in one of the nicest areas, you've got to have a pipe organ. And someone had donated $6,000 toward a pipe organ, and we just said, oh, please, can't you put a little more money? This is, I mean, kind of a show place, and it would be a real, you know, kind of a missionary thing for the church. That's always a selling point. But we were told that you could, at that time, you were permitted to have a pipe organ if someone donated the money in total. But if you didn't have enough, then you had to go with. So our organist asked Alexander Schreiner what's maybe the best kind of electronic, and he said, buy the cheapest one you can. In other words, just junk. What does it matter?
The policy on that continues to change, and the stated policy is not the real policy, and it's the political game to figure out what the real policy is. The comment was that, I'm repeating this for the tape, from Midway, Utah, that the area representative said to a congregation who asked for a pipe organ that they could build four chapels in Africa for the cost of a pipe organ. If I can respond to that, I can say, gee, for the cost of half a gymnasium, we could have a pipe organ.
Thank you very much. I think we're all going to go back to our wards and stakes inspired and talk to the music person on the High Council. Thank you.